Hi there, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for Uneven Distribution here on the Hearsay Culture Network. I'm so glad you're with us here today because we have a fantastic guest for my show. I'm so excited to introduce you to author and journalist Marina Gerner. Hi, Marina.
Hi, I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you, Denise.
It's great to have you. Whether you're new to the show or a longtime listener, well, you can't be that longtime a listener because the show isn't that old yet. But if you've listened to the show before, you know that here on Uneven Distribution, we talk to what I like to call the time travelers among us, the people who are in one way or another living in the future and experiencing things that the rest of us are inevitably about to. And we bring them on to send us dispatches from the future and explain what's coming our way. And Marina has been steeped in and deeply researching and writing a book about the future of women's health and healthcare. Happen to have it here. It is called The Vagina Business. And the first thing I wanted to ask you, Marina, is this wonderful graphic. If you're watching the video of our show, you can see it. It is sort of the classic curved diamond shape of a vagina, but in the middle of it is a USB cable, which is absolutely brilliant. Who came up with that?
Thank you very much. That was the cover designer, Alicia Zepeda. He came up with that. I sent him various examples of how vaginas have been represented symbolically. And then he had this brilliant idea. He actually initially combined two circles and then took, you know, the middle and put the USB into that.
I absolutely love it. And I mean, you are just such a sweet spot for me to sit here and go deep with for a while because number one, women's health is near and dear to my heart, especially as I become older and as I care for and help my mother navigate her 80s now. And also because I'm a technology lawyer and I absolutely love the world of startups. I'm so intrigued by who comes up with what idea and what gets funded and how and why. And that is exactly what your book goes very deep and detailed on. How long have you been researching this?
About 3 years. Yeah. I first got into this field in 2019. It was. So at the time, I learned something new, which really surprised me, which is that if you ask most people to imagine a person who's having a heart attack, you know, who do you see? Most of us think of a man, usually an old man. It's what we tend to see in movies. And he's clutching his chest. He feels a lot of pressure on his chest. There's a pain radiating down his left hand side. And those are the symptoms we typically think of, but those are actually typical symptoms for men, not for women, even though heart disease is the leading cause of death for both men and women. We know much less about how to spot heart issues in women, and women are, as a result, 50% more likely to be given the wrong diagnosis after having a heart attack, and women also wait longer to seek help when they're having heart issues. And the reason is because most of our medical research has focused on the male body. And so our knowledge has been shaped by that. So when medical professionals look at patterns and symptoms, they're used to looking at male patterns and male symptoms. And so 5 years ago, I came across this incredible company called Bloomer Tech, which was spun out of MIT. And they've created the coolest thing. They've created a smart bra, which uses ECG technology, and it helps women who are at risk monitor their heart health. It can also be used for clinical trials remotely to, you know, collect more data on female heart health. And that's actually something the company is currently working on. They're working on a remote clinical trial. And so that can then help us fill the gender data gap in heart health. And so I was amazed to not only discover that there's a problem that most people still don't really know about, but there's also a solution. And there are people who are working on a solution and who are working to address that. And I met the founder at a conference. I was sitting upstairs in a balcony seat and I When she finished talking, I ran downstairs to catch her and to ask for her business card. And I was so excited. You know, I introduced myself. I said, I'm a journalist. I'd love to write about what you're doing. And then I went home and I messaged those editors who always love my stories and who usually say yes to everything. And weirdly, there was no interest. I think at the time, the story was perceived as being a bit niche, you know, a smart bra for what? Mm-hmm. Heart health. And you have to remember this was pre-COVID. And I think once COVID started, everything changed. And if you wanted to be cynical about this, you could say it's because men were initially more affected. They had worse symptoms. Now we know that women tend to have long COVID more than men. But initially, in the first phase of COVID, men were more affected by it. And suddenly, there was more attention towards sex differences in health. And I managed to write the story about the smart bra.
Really intriguing. And I bet that, I mean, you cover a huge array of startups in your book. And most of them I noticed are sort of device or technology focused rather. And there are a good number that are sort of helping people find a community, an app that can connect people going through similar experiences and sharing their own wisdom and knowledge with each other. And some have some therapeutic applications, but it occurs to me that the pandemic probably shifted things from the landscape in 2019 when you first tried to build interest in the smart bra, the life-saving smart bra, in that we became much more focused on technologies that allowed people to stay out of the doctor's office. Yes. And to have more data that they could gather on their own.
Exactly.
And things they can do on their own. And there's so much, so many of the companies that you cover are very proactive in that way. So I thought what we'd do in our conversation today is sort of start on the money side, sort of take this from how companies can begin to glimpse an identity and a reality by getting money. And then go into the whole range of what these kinds of products cover. What is femtech, as you as you've discussed it? And then get it a little bit more sort of economical, philosophical toward the end, if that makes any sense. On the money side, one of my favorite passages in your book was when you live in London. Are you
That's
from
right.
London?
Yes. I live in London. My background's more complicated. I was born in Ukraine. I grew up in Germany. I've lived in the States and I've mainly lived in London at this point.
Right. So at one point researching the book, you describe how you came out to Silicon Valley and you were interviewing some venture capitalists. I grew up in Northern California, so Silicon Valley was always sort of in my backyard. And I loved your perspective coming from the UK, going to Sand Hill Road and realizing there's nothing here. It's just a road in the middle of some rolling hills. And that is, I have to tell you, as a native Californian, that developed fairly organically going all the way back to the days when Silicon Valley actually was a place where silicon chips were made back when I was a kid and before. And so Sand Hill Road just sort of developed along that road that you commented about. And that as we stand here today, the sort of there's nothing here aspect of it is actually a flex. Because, you know, as things get more and more crowded and congested, to be able to just have this out in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by rolling hills, idyllic environment where we can think about the future and improve the future in this serene sort of godlike way that you've, that's Silicon Valley and the venture world in a nutshell. I loved that you went out and experienced that, but you've also learned some really interesting data about, first of all, the makeup of the kinds of companies that you've covered in your book. One thing I found fascinating is the statistic that you would think a lot of these companies were founded by women, and a lot of them have been, but the savvy ones have realized if we have all women involved in the management of this company, we're likely to be less successful. Just as a practical matter, if they add a male to their executive suite, they're going to resonate more with the VC world, which is still largely male. Only 26% of VCs in 2022 were women, up from 23% in 2020. So we're still looking at, you know, more than 75% of the VC world is still male.
Yeah.
And at one point you wrote that one of the founders had literally hired a beard, which I loved.
Thank you. Speak
to that. First of all, the sort of justice injustice of it, and also, you know, the fact that the women founders are recognizing this and doing what they have to get the money and get ahead. I just applaud them, you know, do what you need to do.
Yes, absolutely. The founder you're referring to, yes, she had to literally hire herself a beard. And she said it turned the ship for the company because investors felt that it was one of them who was endorsing the company. I also have a study that I referenced done by Maya Ackerman, and she shows that actually mixed gender teams tend to raise the most money, but as long as they're led by a male CEO. So there's also that to back up that point. But let me tell you how I got into the money angle to begin with. So I wrote about the smart bra, and when that story came out in The Guardian, I was invited to chair a panel at a health tech conference that was focused on female health. And I think my panel was one of the first in the morning. It was all online, and it was about data, I think. And I stayed on and I listened to all the other panels. I was drawn into this space. I was so fascinated by it because I thought, I know about my body, you know, you sort of assume, but then there's so much more to learn. So I was fascinated by what I was hearing. And I was in my early 30s, so I was 31 or 32 at the time. I knew I wanted to have children soon. And I also knew that 9 in 10 first-time mothers experience a birth injury. And it's the kind of thing friends who had already given birth sort of talk about in hushed voices, you know, and sometimes there's also this attitude of like, don't tell her, you might put her off. But it's that kind of thing that I did know about. And I'm the kind of person who prefers to know. I think knowledge is power. So as a journalist, I was really excited when I came across this innovative startup in California that was creating a device that could help us prevent birth injuries, vaginal tearing, and prolapse as well. And so I researched the space and I realized that the latest big innovation in the standard of care in birth was the epidural, which was popularized in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And that's just so mind-boggling.
And when you can we just have a round of applause for the epidural? Thank goodness it's there. But
absolutely. But also a round of applause for like the floppy disk. You know, we don't think of a technology like that as the latest cutting-edge technology anymore. But in birth, we do.
Yeah.
And it's just sad. Why haven't we had hundreds of new creations in the birth space since then? You know, my friends were describing to me that they were giving birth with salad forks and toilet plungers, forceps and vacuum delivery.
Yes.
But they do look like that.
Yeah.
Right.
And the company you're referring to is Materna?
That's right. Materna. Yep. And the device is called Materna Prep.
And so that is a fascinating device because as you point out in your book, you know, we know from our workouts and fitness that muscles respond better when they are stretched before they are put to, you know, the task of some rigorous workout. And, and that doesn't happen in the birth process. There's no advanced stretching that you can, do, you know, or have been able to do until this product comes to market, which it has not yet, right?
Still in development. Not yet. It is. It's still being tested, still in clinical trials. I mean, there are other things people have done traditionally, like perineal massage, to kind of try and stretch that area. But this is the first device of its kind, you know, that's a medical device.
Yeah. And what I mean, I don't know what percentage of women wind up vaginally delivering worldwide, but I would imagine it's quite high.
Yes. It's the majority, I believe. So about in the States, about 30% of births are C-sections.
Right.
So yeah, I would assume.
So the
that means the vast majority are vaginal births.
So the injury issue is with those 70% going.
What's
through.
An injury either way? A C-section is also an injury and can be quite painful too.
Yeah.
So I was talking to startup founders in the space of this company and of other companies, and I heard again and again that it's very hard to raise money for incredible creations like this one, because investors who are, as you said, predominantly male, don't want to talk about vaginas. And one VC investor, I have this quote in the book, one investor says, I don't want to talk about vaginas in my Monday morning partner meeting, because it's this idea of, your vaginas have no place in the business setting. You know, how could you possibly say that word?
Right. So much opportunity there. That was not the most insightful observation.
No, absolutely. And it's also how we all got here, right? So it's just, it's a word. It's an important word. And, you know, it was really important for me for that word to be on the cover of the book as well, to kind of help normalize and destigmatize the word.
I've been reading your book for the last week, and I've been subjected to the titters of my male family members as they've walked by me with the big cover. So they got used to it after a while.
I'm assuming they probably got used to it.
They did. And I read your whole introduction to venture capital. You do a great little background sort of synopsis for people who aren't familiar with that process. I read the whole thing to my son, who's a business major in college right now. And he was unfamiliar. I mean, he's heard the term before, but he didn't really understand how it worked. So that was a great primer for him. And he had to look at the cover of your book the whole time I was reading it. So that was perfect.
Great. So that's an education, you know, in two ways.
Absolutely.
Which is excellent. I teach business students as well at NYU Stern. So I'm used to talking to that demographic. And I really hope that the book will speak to them. This realization that it was stigma and embarrassment that stands in the way of innovation and of us getting the products that we want and deserve, that realization really shook me to the core. I was so angry to learn about this. So I wrote a story for Wired magazine. It was called "We Need to Talk About Investors' Problem with Vaginas." And the story went viral. And suddenly I was getting messages from people like Cindy Gallup. And, you know, I realized it really hit a nerve. And I was so fascinated and so passionate about the topic, and I wanted to explore and research. So I knew I wanted to devote all of my energy to this topic. And I spent 3 years interviewing over 100 people, founders, researchers, and investors across the board. I wanted to give a really broad overview of the space that people can see different areas of it.
I really enjoy your writing style. It's both educational and light and breezy and entertaining at the same time, which is just great. It's a great way to get through the material. And I also really appreciate the fact how well-sourced your book is and how the sources are there at the back of the book with an index too. The English major in me just absolutely adores that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. There are a couple of quotes that I sent you about this space by other authors that I thought were a nice complement to what you wrote. There's an article that I read about startups in this space where a senior person at Deloitte named Heather Gates said, part of the challenge is the nature of women-owned businesses and founders' approaches. Even when they found great businesses, women are less likely to swing for the fences. She said that instead of pitching their companies as the next member of the Magnificent Seven, women founders may position them as incremental advances or niche plays. Such modesty doesn't light up the scoreboard for venture funders seeking a healthy return on their capital. I'm wondering what you think of that. Do you think it's accurate?
It sounds a bit like victim blaming to me, to be honest. I've spoken to so many founders and I've never heard anyone say, oh, I'm just making a small incremental change or I have a niche product. I've never heard anyone say that.
Touché. Founders never think that way. But to the extent they do, I feel like women have a different just approach, mentality. Maybe I'm stereotyping, but perhaps they're just a little bit less bombastic and a little bit more realistic.
Yeah, of course. And that's not always a bad thing at all. We've seen so many companies with huge valuations, you know, who don't really make a profit and so on. So a bit of realism is definitely good. But one thing I hear from founders is actually the reverse, that they pitch their product. They say, this is something that could help 51% of the population. And then investors respond, oh, it sounds a bit niche. Mm-hmm. So it's something they tend to hear from investors. And I think it's worth pointing out that female founders face very specific biases from investors. So for instance, there's a study from Professor Dana Kanze from 2018. She found that investors are more likely to ask male entrepreneurs questions about their potential. So they're more likely to ask questions like, what is your aspiration? Where do you want to get to if everything's fine? You know, what does success look like? Whereas with female entrepreneurs, they're much more likely to ask skeptical questions, like how do you prevent people from gaming your game? And how long will it take for you to break even? And can you talk a little bit about the competitive environment? You know, so they ask men questions that can lead to promotion, that can help them promote themselves, whereas they ask women based on prevention and skepticism. And that bias is not only true for male investors, it's also true for female investors. So I think that's something that I found really interesting. It's a sort of general bias.
Right.
General perception.
Part of that's human nature. I think you write about one of the investors that you document who had a fascination with dog food immediately after he had acquired a puppy, which is just what I think that's how startups and the VC world work, right? There are problems that are personal to the people involved that resonate with them, and it either prompts them to found a company or fund a company, right?
Exactly. So, absolutely. Yes. I tell the story of how the investor was, you know, talking in very general terms about how great this dog food company is. And then he left the table and his colleague said, oh, you know, he bought a puppy recently. And so he's obsessed with this dog food company.
Right.
And so it's absolutely true that investors want to fund what they want to see in the world. And pretty much every founder in the femtech space, in the women's health innovation space, has a personal story for why they've created what they're working on. So that's definitely a big motivating factor.
Well, so for men and male investors in the healthcare arena, they would probably be, even if they're squeamish about things related to reproductive health, something related to erectile dysfunction might resonate more with them, or prostate health, which is so important to men as they get older. And as we move on to some of the companies that have been successful in this space, mm-hmm. I found another article from Going VC that listed the 7 femtech unicorns at the moment. This was last fall. And at the top of the list is Row Health. And it is way out in front of the rest of them at a $7 billion valuation, with Myovant Sciences, which is more of a drug therapy related company, I think. And Progyny down below it, far behind it, at $2.7 billion valuations apiece. But Row Health's main product is an erectile dysfunction product. I don't know how it got on this list. I think it has like a women's health clinic that is part of its expanded universe of healthcare services. What did you think of this list?
I noticed the same thing. I think out of that list, the companies that I would classify as femtech are Maven Clinic, Flow, Progyny, and some would argue Kindbody, although Kindbody you could say is just a new chain of fertility clinics. So 3.5 out of 7, I would say, are femtech, which stands for, we should say, female technology, you know, technology focused on female bodies. It was coined by Ida Tin, the founder of the period app Clue, in 2016. And the reason she came up with this term is because she wanted to give investors a term they could use instead of saying, oh, I have a portfolio company that helps women not pee their pants. So she wanted to give them something they could work with and they could be comfortable with. And then I think the other thing that's worth saying is that people often think that women's health is confined to our reproductive organs, you know, vaginas and the uterus, but women's health goes way beyond the ovaries. It's often defined as encompassing issues that affect us primarily, like periods, differently, like heart health, which we already spoke about, and disproportionately like bone health, for example. So 80% of Americans with osteoporosis, for example, are women. So that's one definition that McKinsey and Fem Health Insights have used, you know, primarily, differently, and disproportionately. But the more I looked into female health in the book, the more I realized that definition actually covers pretty much everything, because everything is so interconnected in the female body. You know, our hormones influence everything. Our ovaries signal to the brain, for example, the hormone prolactin affects your breast cancer risk. You know, UTIs can affect your breast tissue. So there's nothing gender neutral in health, is the conclusion I've arrived at.
Right. And you alluded to this already in talking about COVID and its disparate impact on people of different sexes.
Yes.
And you write in the book about an instructor at a medical school who polled her students on things that she, you know, they think would be important to include in a study on the effectiveness of a COVID vaccine. And the thing that got left out that they all thought would be important was, tell us.
Yes, it was sex.
Yeah. and apparently, you know, the COVID vaccines, I'm sure they're still being studied ad nauseum, yes. But one thing that has come out is that they do impact people of different sexes differently.
Yes, absolutely. And slowly we are seeing those studies, but at the time the first phases did not look at that. And the students were really surprised because that seemed like a no-brainer to them to, aggregate their data by sex. But unfortunately, that's still not the norm. So even though we now have more women in clinical trials, and it's worth remembering that women and people of color were only included in 1993. So that's really not that long ago, what, 3 decades ago? So we have managed to increase the number of women in clinical trials, but then researchers don't pull that data apart a lot of the time. And they even include various excuses in their papers as to why they didn't do that. So I cite one example where on animal studies, where the researchers said that, the cages of female mice were just much harder to clean, and so we didn't include them.
it's so resonant with me, my own interactions with our healthcare system, my mother's interactions with our healthcare system, because on the one hand, we are so lucky to live where we do and enjoy the benefits of the medical care that we can receive in countries like the UK and the United States. Yes. However, I think you'd be hard pressed to find people who still living in those very privileged countries who still wouldn't find all kinds of things to complain about concerning their healthcare, all kinds of shortcomings and shortfalls and how it could be better. And while I'm certainly glad that no one is bloodletting me or applying leeches anymore, we've come a long way. There's still so much further to come. And that's what a lot of these founders are doing. So let's talk about some of the specific areas they're targeting. You mentioned the it's hard to sell a product that helps customers not pee their pants.
Yes.
Pelvic floor health is something I never heard of until long after I delivered my child. And I didn't hear about it in the medical context. I heard about it in the fitness context, in the well-being context, because I have done yoga for years. I've done Pilates for somewhat fewer years, but several. And the instructors there are very dialed in to the fact that we need to pay attention to this, particularly in connection with childbirth, after childbirth, as we get older. It's a very critical part of health function, and yet it's not very discussed or very addressed. And a lot of the founders that you chronicle are targeting that area. Tell us about the importance of pelvic floor health.
Absolutely. It's hugely important. I think the statistic is something like 50% of women will have some pelvic floor issue in their lifetime. And you're more likely to have it if you've had a vaginal delivery, if you're menopausal, and also if you're just older.
And in addition to incontinence, there can be this, it's called prolapse, right?
That's right. Yes. Most people haven't heard of that, but pelvic organ prolapse is, unfortunately, really common.
And this is literally your organs moving out of place and beginning to fall.
Exactly. Yes. So you can picture the pelvic floor like a seat belt holding everything together, and the organs are beginning to move down, and it can require surgery. It can be extremely painful. And a lot of this can be avoided with pelvic floor exercises. So there are some countries, including France and Germany, where pelvic floor health is taken seriously, and women who have given birth are sent to do a course. And the insurer will chase you if you haven't done your course. They'll message you saying, have you done your course? Have you done your pelvic floor training? But that's still quite exceptional. I think for most women in the US and in the UK, it's more a matter of looking things up on YouTube and figuring out how to do it yourself, or you know, in some cases, looking for a physiotherapist who can help with that, because they're not just Kegel exercises, they're also lunges and other types of exercises you can do to strengthen the pelvic floor. And those exercises are good for men too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just in a yoga class. I've sort of stepped up my yoga game as I've gotten older to incorporate more weights, because that is something my doctor is on me about.
Great.
Not losing muscle mass
yes.
as you get older and working more with weights. So I'm in this very aggressive yoga class right now that it's like you're going to the club. Yeah. There's just pumping music, and the women, mostly women who teach it, but they're personal trainers and they're, you know, they have a lot of male clients. So I was in a class that was maybe 70% female and 30% male the other day. And the instructor was just on and on and on about, we are going to contract our pelvic floor throughout this entire class. And she reminded people throughout wow. the class, and she would, for people who were unfamiliar with the concept, she would explain exactly what to do. And for the men, she said, guys, just suck in your balls. You know, so it's important that they also avoid prolapse and things. And this one instructor was definitely right on it. Let's talk about...
She sounds excellent, yes.
Oh, yeah, she was wonderful. She kicked my butt. So, of course, pregnancy and delivery support. We've talked a little bit about that already with Materna trying to avoid injury during... the actual delivery process. Any other interesting companies you'd want to highlight that address that very important aspect of our health lives?
Yes, absolutely. I think what's amazing is that so many pregnancies are still unintended. I think half of all pregnancies are unintended. And the go-to recommendation for people who want to conceive is to have sex every other day. I think, which is not very precise when you think about it. You can only really get pregnant for about 5 days of the month. I mean, the egg lives for about 24 hours, but then sperm can live for a couple of days. So I think we're going to see much more precision in that space as people are tracking their cycles in all these different ways, either through apps or through the body temperature. And I write about different ways in which you can track your cycle. So you can use your spit, for example. There's a company in Berlin called Inne that's created a small gadget. It looks like a headphone case. And you lick a stick, put it into the gadget, and then it can track your progesterone levels, so it can track your cycle that way. There's another device that you can breathe into, and it can measure the CO2 levels, which correlate with your estrogen levels, so it can track your cycle in that way. There's another device that can track your cervical mucus, which is called KEG. So there are all these different ways in which we're learning about our cycles. So
yeah.
I think the way we think about conception will change. And then once you've given birth, you have breastfeeding, and you know, you have nowadays you have the modern breast pump. So I cover LV in the book, which is a hands-free, silent breast pump that's really convenient and very different from the traditional breast pump that was cumbersome and that was not hands-free and that didn't let you move around and get on with your day.
And just wasn't very effective. The, you know, I used whatever the popular brand was, but, you know, as far as milk production went, it just was paltry compared to what the actual child could accomplish. So it wasn't that helpful, unfortunately.
Yes.
And it was big and cumbersome and loud and all the rest.
Well,
so the fact that folks are improving on those is Wonderful news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you're breastfeeding, it's, you know, I have a 5-month-old baby. I am breastfeeding and my breast pump buys me freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can go to events. I've just spent 8 days at a recording studio recording my audiobook. And that's thanks to the breast pump in part.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible thing. And then there's another device I covered called the CoroFlow, which is not on the market yet. It's a nipple shield that can measure the amount of milk a baby is getting. Because one of the reasons for why women stop breastfeeding is they don't know how much milk the baby's getting, whether it's enough
mm-hmm.
or not. So it has a sensor that can measure that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I actually went to the hospital where I delivered, which happens to be right around the corner, thankfully, and was able to track that. You know, there were specialists there who could tell mm-hmm. me how much milk the baby was mm-hmm. getting. But to be able to do that at home would be magnificent.
Absolutely. I think it even shows you which you can switch between your breasts, and it shows you the amount on an app. So
mm-hmm.
it's super convenient.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the juicy part. Let's talk about sexual wellness and the juicy part.
Yes.
No pun intended. you had a line in your book about 2012 being 10 years too early for Bloomingdale's to have a whole section devoted to this. But by 2022, you know, I don't know. Can we thank Gwyneth Paltrow too for her eggs and such things?
Yes. I think we can in part. Yeah, yes. It's become its own category now. Sexual wellness can be found at Bloomingdale's, at Sephora,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So we find ourselves in a different environment now compared to 10 years ago. And I think that now there is a recognition that sexual health and sexual pleasure is part of your overall health. And education is a big piece of that. So the companies I cover include Oh My God Yes, you know, which is a big research project on female sexual pleasure, and also the Lioness Vibrator, which can map female orgasms on an app by measuring pelvic floor contractions. And nobody has collected that kind of data before. So it's incredible to be able to see that and conduct research with that. And then on the flip side of pleasure, there's also pelvic pain and pain with sex. So there are several femtech startups that focus on that too.
My favorite one that you cover in the book is the Internet of Dongs Project. As a privacy lawyer and as someone with a sense of humor, I have to just give these people their props. They are a married couple who hacks sex toys to test their security and privacy features and yes. then expose, you know, the flaws, the various ways in which there could be a data breach or an unauthorized access to information from these quote unquote smart devices. So mm-hmm. God love them. These don't seem like a couple that are seeking venture funding. They seem like they're in it for public service and welfare.
Yes. Yes, exactly. It's just a, you know, it's a hobby for them. It's something they do to kind of help their own community. They have day jobs at big software companies and they do this on the side. And, you know, they said to me that they realized other people were looking into smart thermostats and fridges, but nobody was looking into sex toys, and everybody deserves to be safe, whether that's your baby monitor or your fridge or your sex toy. And I think that's very true.
Right. They are part of the Internet of Things.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
We were talking about tracking conception, and of course, infertility is a rising problem in the world. I think I read that between 17 and 18% of people globally experience infertility and that is on the rise. So some of the products you've already mentioned are already addressing that by helping people track their cycles. I'm wondering if you've stumbled across anything. Freezing your eggs is such an expensive and definitely a privileged thing to do, but it is something that I think a lot of people, once they get pretty far along the way in their fertility journey or infertility journey, had wished they had done. Have you come across anybody trying to improve that situation, make it more accessible, more affordable?
Yes, I have. Yes, I think egg freezing is a really interesting and in some ways shocking space I have found. So egg freezing was developed in the 1980s to be used for medical purposes. You know, the idea behind medical egg freezing was to preserve the eggs of someone who's about to undergo fertility threatening treatments like chemotherapy, for example. And then about two decades ago, they invented vitrification, which was a new way of freezing eggs. So that made the process more reliable. And egg freezing was commercialized for non-medical reasons. So in 2012, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine lifted the experimental label of the egg freezing procedure. And since then, social egg freezing has been on the rise, and it is offered to, you know, healthy young women who want to postpone motherhood. And we've seen lots of celebrities talk about this openly. So Kim Kardashian has frozen her eggs. Jennifer Aniston has said she regrets not freezing her eggs. And the uptake has been exponential. But there are several problems I see in this space. The first one is that the cost is, as you say, it's really expensive. And oftentimes it's not transparent, because you need to do multiple tests beforehand. Then you need the egg retrieval, oftentimes multiple rounds. After that, you need to store the eggs. After that, you need to have IVF and so on. And most clinics are not transparent about the price. I have seen some that are changing that in the femtech space. So Apricity, for example, is a clinic that's being very transparent about the cost. Then another issue is that the likelihood of a live birth is not spoken about or not made clear enough as well. You know, you need a relatively high number of eggs to have a chance to then have a live birth.
Right.
And I think some clinics just say, oh, you know, have one round, have a few eggs, and that will be your insurance. But it's very unlikely that it's going to work out if you only have a few eggs and if you've frozen them at an advanced age, which leads me to the next issue. So ideally you'd freeze your eggs in your 20s or early 30s, but the data shows us that on average women are around 38 years old when they freeze their eggs. So that means you really need a very, very large number. The other problem is that clinics tend to downplay the risks involved, but it's quite a brutal procedure and it can have various side effects from nausea to ovarian hyperstimulation. So that's something else. And the final aspect is that most eggs that have been frozen recently have not actually been used. They haven't been defrosted. So we don't actually have that much data on recent rounds of egg freezing.
Right, because it takes someone probably 10 to 15 years if they do it in their early 20s before they're even thinking about that.
Exactly. And it also just seems like many women don't return to these eggs.
Yeah, they're an insurance policy.
Well, apart from the fact that an insurance policy pays out, whereas this does not necessarily,
yes,
right? This does not necessarily work out.
Yeah.
But I think in the future, egg freezing might look radically different in that it could become much more affordable. It could become much more transparent and safe and accessible and effective to an extent where women in their 20s decide to, you know, just freeze a small number of eggs to preserve their quality just in case. That could happen in the future because clinics also vary in how good they are at fertilization. So the air quality inside the laboratory matters, and shining a red light on sperm cells also improves their performance. Apparently, a thin layer of diamond on the petri dish could also help. So there are various things that can improve the process. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing about this, I thought, well, egg freezing could also fall out of favor for cultural reasons, potentially, if governments introduced better childcare policies, you know, if workplaces made it easier for people to have a family at the same time, if we made life easier for single parents and so on. But it's very sad to think that this scenario is actually much less likely than the technology-driven ones.
Yes, it is sad to think of that. And I have actually seen companies, I can't remember off the top of my head who they were, hoping to recruit and keep female employees who build this into their healthcare offerings. We will support you and underwrite you if you want to freeze your eggs to keep you a productive and hardworking worker bee in our establishment. If you're worried about that and you want to delay having children, we're gonna help you do that.
It would be great to have some parental leave, some well-paid parental leave right. too, right? That's exactly. An option. I mean, good to have options. And then the other option is that scientists could find a way to shield our egg quality from going down with age. Mm-hmm. That could potentially happen. And there's a whole other option, which is, so last year, researchers in Japan managed to turn the stem cells of male mice into egg cells. And those egg cells were then implanted in female mice who gave birth to babies. So that could one day translate into human research.
Wow. So, yeah, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. And in that case, you know, we don't even need eggs to begin with.
Right. Another area of healthcare that women are plagued by, of course, is breast cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, fibroids. What have you seen as far as startups looking to improve the lots of women dealing with those situations?
Yes, absolutely. I think there are some startups that are working on fibroids in particular and how to treat those in less destructive, less invasive ways. And I've also seen a lot of interesting research around the risk factors for breast cancer and for ovarian cancer. So I think more and more research is coming out on that. So when you're breastfeeding, for example, that decreases your risk for breast cancer down the line. Whereas if you're taking hormone replacement therapy, that increases your risk for ovarian cancer. It decreases some other risks. But I think there will be much more awareness around the risk factors that lead to different types of cancers, and people will be able to adjust their lifestyles more and, you know, consider their circumstances more. So, well, it's a case of personalized medicine, I guess.
Yeah, and the case of preventative medicine versus reactive medicine. And you do talk about that quite a lot in the book. And the CEO of one of the companies you cover, LV, has a quote there that where she says, there's always an economic case for the health systems to invest in preventative care for women. And she was discussing her partnership with the National Health Service in the UK for pelvic trainers, which you mentioned earlier that in the UK, with a public healthcare system, this is actually something that's offered. And as you said, apparently even women are, you got to do this, you know, they're bugged by their healthcare system until they check this box. Here in the US, where we have a different approach to healthcare and sort of a mixed bag of publicly funded and privately funded healthcare systems, mm-hmm. I think we have a different dynamic that comes into play when it comes to preventative healthcare. All the healthcare systems are going to tell you how committed they are to preventative healthcare. But when the rubber hits the road, you see discrepancies. For example, Kaiser, which is the largest managed healthcare system in the United States, and it treats 40% of patients in California, they stop routine breast cancer screening for women at age 75, as though breast cancer is just not going to happen for most women after that. And of course, especially as people's lives are prolonged and their quality of life is better in later years, to be sidelined by breast cancer because you're not being routinely screened just seems like a terrible situation to be in. Yes. And it does seem like perhaps there might be a way to put that more in the patient's hands and give them access to screening that they might not be provided from their healthcare system. What do you think is the overall picture when it comes to preventative care?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It completely depends on the healthcare system that you're in and what the financial incentives are that are driving that system. You know, one parallel I can think of are C-sections. Mm-hmm. So C-sections are more expensive than a vaginal delivery. I think a vaginal delivery is about 30% cheaper. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have to question why the rate of C-sections is so high in the US, whereas in other places that have public healthcare systems, maybe some women do not get help, do not get C-sections because those would cost the system more. And so they're instead pushed into vaginal deliveries they might not want to have. And it's, I think it's a similar scenario where you have to think about, you know, who's paying and what are the structures around that.
Right. I didn't confront this in my own childbirth journey, but I certainly have friends and acquaintances who elected to pick a day when their child was going to be born and, yes, you know, just didn't want to put yes themselves at risk of vaginal delivery and or didn't want to go through labor or, you know, in consultation right with their doctors, they just decided that was the best thing. And I wonder what the insurance calculus is on that, because mm-hmm, as you say, it's a more expensive probably mm-hmm procedure, mm-hmm, but it does seem to be readily available for those who decide with their doctors that this is the best thing for them.
Good, because I have a few friends here in the UK who had to really fight to get an elective mm-hmm C-section, who had to, you know, make their case repeatedly, who just knew from the start that they didn't want to go through labor, they didn't want a vaginal delivery, mm-hmm, and that, you know, that should be normally fine. It should be totally fine, totally accepted for right women to be able to make that choice, but they had to fight for it.
Right. You talk about several companies that are addressing the needs of women internationally on the healthcare front. And we've already discussed how fortunate we are to be in countries where our healthcare systems are comparatively quite good, yes, as opposed to what you might encounter abroad in certain ways. One company I thought we should talk about that you cover is Vitala. Am I saying that right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, which has a safe medical abortion assistance app that they've mm-hmm targeted in Venezuela because abortions are illegal in Venezuela. So they help women basically end run that and give them resources on how they can have a safe, what do we call it when you're, is it a medical
abortion?
Yes, that's right, exactly. You're not going in for a procedure. You're taking
two different kinds of pills, and it's very safe and very reliable. And so women can self-manage the abortion in right the privacy of their home.
Right.
Exactly. So they're giving women, you know, the information that they need, and women can talk to someone through the app. They go through a questionnaire to make sure that they can use the pills, and then they're told how to get those pills from grassroots organizations. And it's comparable to harm reduction counseling is what it's called in Venezuela, which is sort of tolerated. So they took that idea and put it into an app. And as far as I know, they're working on expanding the app into various US states as well.
Yeah, because various US states are making it harder and harder yes. to obtain an abortion in the wake of the Dobbs decision. So it's a good synergy for here too. But I got exactly. nervous as yeah. I was reading this yes. part of your book. Do we want to be talking about Vitala? Are its users or the company itself going to be jeopardized in Venezuela when the government realizes what's going on?
I was wondering that too, but you know, the founder told me that the World Health Organization wrote a whole report about them, and you know, they're not secretive about what they do. They have a website and they've been written about, and I think they've done so much research on the context in Venezuela that they're able to navigate how to do that mm-hmm. and how to keep people safe. And I'm sure that whichever state they went for next, they would do the research and really figure out how to get the pills to people. And I feel like abortion pills, it's one of those things where now that they exist, they're really hard to reverse. mm-hmm. It's one of these creations, one of these inventions that's just groundbreaking.
Right. It's wonderful that there's a company like Vitala out there who's working with the World Health Organization and making sure that the products that are getting into people's hands are safe and are not just some charlatan site on the internet capitalizing exactly. on demand and need.
Exactly. Yeah. Because those could be very expensive, or they could just be sugar pills, right? So
right. Or worse, unsafe, right? They could do worse, terrible yes. harm.
Yes, exactly.
One thing I noted down here that I wanted to talk to you about that's not in your book, or maybe it is, but I haven't gotten there yet, is one routine thing that happens here in the United States. I'm not sure if you have this in the UK, is as you are giving birth, you're asked if you would like to donate the cord blood stem cells for research purposes. And right. I mean, I think the vast majority of people do this. Why would you just throw away something that's extraordinarily valuable for research and scientific advancement? So I think the vast majority of us decide to donate our stem cells. But I'm wondering if there's some company out there who has targeted the fact that later on in life, we come back around and we need those stem cells reinjected into yes. our joints, because they are very therapeutic if you are having shoulder or knee or other issues. Yes. One of the things your orthopedist will tell you is, well, we have these stem cell treatments, but they may or may not be covered by insurance. And if they're not covered by insurance, they are very expensive. I think we need a bank. Mm-hmm. If you donate in, you should be able to withdraw out.
Yes. Yes, I agree. Yeah, it's not something you get asked here. And I haven't done a ton of research on this, but I know that about 3% of people do donate it in the US, which is the highest rate in the world, as far as I know. In the UK, it's only 0.3%.
Huh. It's only 3%.
Yes.
Because I think everybody is asked. That's really strange.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about whether you donate it or whether, you know, lots of people keep it for themselves. So in case the child needs it one day, and that's a really big business opportunity. But in some ways, that model makes less sense than the donation model, because I was reading that if there is a genetic disease, then that can already be present in the cord blood. So it's actually more helpful to find a match of somebody else who does not have that information in the cord blood.
Right.
And so a kind of donation philanthropic model makes more sense.
Right. One of the things you touch on in the book, as far as the discrepancies that you mentioned early on in our show here, that the healthcare system has developed its models and knowledge base primarily by studying men, as we've gotten to more modern eras, that is shifting. But I'm wondering if you feel that even though men have gotten a lot of attention from the healthcare system, and they do not get told when they sign up to have a prescription for, say, erectile dysfunction drugs, that these are geriatric in some way, whereas any pregnancy over the age of 35 is classified as that. is both more carefully monitored in some ways, which is great, but it's also sort of a stigma.
Yes, absolutely. There are so many terms like that, like geriatric pregnancy and incompetent uterus, I think is another one.
I haven't heard that one.
Yes, yeah. And morning sickness is also a weird one, because it sounds a little bit, it doesn't sound that bad, but it can be completely debilitating for some women. And it doesn't just happen in the morning. So there are definitely terms that we use for women that we just wouldn't ever use for men. And we don't say, here's your geriatric pack of Viagra. We don't say that.
No, we don't. Speaking of morning sickness, that's one topic we didn't touch on. Are any of your startups that you've interviewed or covered, they haven't been able to tackle that one?
No, I haven't seen anything on that, unfortunately.
Yeah, that is too bad, because it's super severe for some people.
Mm-hmm.
But back to men, my own sort of anecdotal observation of the men that I know both well and sort of at a distance is that they also have various taboos and things that they're uncomfortable discussing even about themselves, as opposed to the female sex.
Yes.
And they can be a little private and a little, for lack of a word, neglectful.
Yes.
Again, without wanting to stereotype too badly here, I feel like women are more proactive about going to their doctors and mm-hmm. being forthright mm-hmm. with their doctors. And yet I know men who will go years between checkups, if they go at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if there's a similar market of products and services for them, and mm-hmm. if that's going to be perhaps your next book.
Yeah, I think you're right that men don't tend to communicate these things. Men are expected to be more stoic and less emotional. But the flip side of that is that when a man turns up and comes to hospital and says, I think I'm having a heart attack, then he is taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a woman is told, oh, you have indigestion or anxiety or depression. So there's that. The other thing I find interesting is that, 8 out of 10 drugs that were withdrawn from the market between 1997 and 2000 were withdrawn because of adverse effects they had on women. So there really is this huge discrepancy still. So I think I'm going to keep focusing on women. Yes, of course, there are male health issues that are under researched, and there are autoimmune diseases that affect men that need much more attention and so on. But so much of our medical knowledge is based on men, and so much of our research is still focused on men. Another statistic I came across is that there are, 5 times more studies on erectile dysfunction than PMS, even though 19%, so 19% of men have erectile dysfunction, but 90% of women have PMS. So there really is this huge discrepancy. And people often say to me, why is there such a thing as femtech when there's no such thing as mentech? But this just goes to show, you know, most tech is mentech to some extent at this point. And I hope that one day we'll live in a world that doesn't need the term femtech, because all of tech serves us equally, but we're not quite there yet.
Yes. Well, let's look, let's gaze into our crystal balls and look at the future, jump ahead 11 years to 2035. What are some things that you fully expect to see in the world then that we don't have now?
I think AI will play a big role. And it already does. There's a company called Embryonics, for example, that aims to improve IVF. So in IVF, an egg is fertilized with sperm in a lab, and the clump of cells is then transferred into the uterus. And so an embryologist will choose which clumps of cells to transfer. And they do that with chromosomal testing and also by looking at the appearance. And so if you take an AI model that has analyzed lots of images and then pairs the patient it's looking at with previous patients, you can support the doctor with that decision. And I think we will see AI doing similar things across the diagnostic space. As we're already seeing it in fertility.
Right. I'm so glad you brought that up, because one thing I was struck by in reviewing the companies that you document in your book is not many of them are leaning too heavily on AI at this point. But I imagine that will change rapidly just in the next few years.
Yes, absolutely. I definitely expect to see that in 2035. I think a lot of healthcare will happen at home. So going back to pre-COVID and post-COVID, we now see so much at-home testing, because we realized that people could test themselves for COVID, right? Everybody has become really comfortable with that idea, both physicians and patients. So there'll be much more at-home testing, and so HPV tests can now be done at home, for example. We'll see much more telehealth, remote health, and the likes of Maven Clinic.
Right. And just in the last few years, we've seen the ability, and I know this because I have older parents who monitor these things now on their own at home, of being able to monitor your heart. My dad has arrhythmia. There are tools that very accurately can feed to his doctor and give them information about how his heart is doing, you know, not quite in real time, but close to it, and without the need for a doctor visit. And then my mother monitors her blood pressure every day with a device that has an app that goes to her phone. Those sort of baseline things that you used to go to the doctor for monitoring could very much become more part of our daily routine at home.
Yes, exactly. There's one company I cover called Bloom Life that does remote fetal monitoring.
Oh, wow. Well. So that's cool.
Thing, you know, performing the non-stress test remotely. So that's pretty much on the horizon. We may also be able to delay menopause to some extent. So there are two trials right now that are happening. One is in the early stages, done on mice and cats, to see whether a pharmaceutical version of the anti-malarian hormone could slow down ovarian function. And another clinical trial is happening at Columbia University, where women are given a immunosuppressive drug that also seems to slow down ovarian decline. So
that would extend your fertility.
It could. I guess the question that I'm often thinking about is whether we want to delay menopause or not. And yes, with women who have an early onset of menopause, for medical reasons, absolutely. But I do wonder whether we actually want to delay menopause or not. And it seems to me that women who have gone through menopause are actually very happy to be rid of their periods, whereas women my age in their mid-30s think they want to delay menopause. So there seems to be a generational difference there.
Right. And you haven't explicitly said it, but if you delay menopause such that you can continue to get pregnant later and later on in life, you're not doing anything about the aging of your eggs. And the fact that they do call at some point a geriatric pregnancy is probably an apt moniker, maybe not at age 38, but, at age 48, maybe so.
Yes, exactly. Egg quantity and egg quality are two different things. Absolutely. And whether you can carry a pregnancy as well is another, is another aspect of it.
Right. Well, Marina, we could go on all day, and you've written such a great book, and I hope people will pick it up. The Vagina Business. I hope they'll read it just for their own edification and knowledge about what's coming down the pipe in the near and further term future. And also, I hope that VCs and aspiring tech company founders will read it and become inspired to continue to address these issues. Is there anything that we...
I hope so too.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything that we haven't covered today that you'd like to leave our listeners and viewers with before we sign off?
We've covered so many things. I think to come back to the main theme of your podcast, it's interesting to think that with technology, there's often an adoption curve, right? So we've seen... that menstruation has to some extent been destigmatized, and now menopause is slowly coming out of the shadows as well. So
yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting to see the adoption curve of both cultural acceptance and technological acceptance. And then the other thing I've noticed is that people often think that these issues around the low levels of funding for vagina-centric companies, that that's just a matter of a couple of years, and that, you know, surely that can't still be happening in 10 years' time. But I think that the future can sometimes be very slow. So when you look at forecasts from the World Economic Forum, they say that it will take us 268 years to close the economic gender gap.
Wow.
So so these things can actually take longer than we expect in some cases.
Yeah, that's sobering. Well, let's hope the founders in your book and others who follow in their footsteps manage to prove that statistic wrong.
And I hope so too.
And continue to forge ahead with the great things they're doing to address problems in the world and make the world a better place.
Yes, absolutely. Because women's health is a $1 trillion opportunity, according to McKinsey and many others. So, you know, it's smart to get on board.
Absolutely. Marina, thank you so much for the great work and research you did for this book and for spending so much time with me today to go through these issues and to help people understand them better.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure talking to you.
And we're so glad of you, our audience here at Hearsay Culture, that you've joined us today, that you continue to check out our other podcasts at hearsayculture.com. We have many offerings for your listening pleasure, all of which are designed to delve into complicated issues in the world and society and make them more comprehensible and more useful in your daily lives. So please check out our other podcasts. Please come back and tune back into Uneven Distribution, which we publish twice a month. Look forward to seeing you on our next episode. Until then, thanks, Marina, and all of you, please take care.
Thank you.